just being a dad and just somehow not being absent gets you, you know, a number one dad award. We have such a privilege to be present and get awarded for it and rewarded for it, as opposed to actually struggling with it and working hard at it and making it like a really big deal.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with George A. George co-founded Greater Good Studio with his wife and partner, Sarah, and a commitment to advancing equity with design. Before that, he spent 7 years at global innovation firm IDEO and was, for a brief time, the first human-centered designer at the Chicago Transit Authority. Since founding Greater Good, George has worked across complex social issues such as criminal justice, civic engagement, public education, public health, and youth development. George is also a frequent speaker, workshop facilitator, and an adjunct full professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. George is dad to an 8-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 4-month-old. This is a big episode. We cover a lot of ground and some pretty heavy emotional stuff. George talks about his personal struggle with extrinsic motivation and the lasting effects guilt, shame, and expectation can have on children and their children for generations to come. He explains how he and his wife and co-founder implement family systems to handle household drudgery and how they hold each other accountable with brutal honesty and critical feedback. We also talk about how Buddhism, specifically meditation and reincarnation, offer a release valve for modern life. Trust me, you'll want to listen to the whole 90 minutes. Like, the number of times that Maris and I had conversations about balance, about her career, my career, about how to fit kids into the mix, and she would reference what you and Sarah work hard to do in like in terms of parenting, in terms of kind of questioning, you know, the sort of definitions that society says, well, you know, this is what, you know, this is what men do who provide, this is what partners do, this is what it looks like to run a business with your spouse. Like, she felt like you actively like railed against some of those definitions. And so she would bring it up all the time, and I didn't get to bear witness to it because I never worked for Greater Good, but it struck me as like, okay, cool. Like, they may be doing some things differently. I mean, just the fact that you're running your own studio and the nature of the work of the studio and the fact that you're a husband and wife team, like, those are three attributes all by themselves that are unique, that most people sidestep. You know, most people don't strike out on their own.
Yeah.
Most people don't want to partner with their spouse, and most people don't want to do like good work for the greater good of society.
Yeah, I don't know if I would necessarily recommend any of the things that we just did to anyone else, because I do think it's like unnecessarily hard, the approach we've taken. And to do all three together is just insane. So I recognize that. Sarah is unusually good at what she does, though. And if you haven't, you know, if you weren't aware that she this wouldn't work if it weren't for how good she was. And I think, sadly, I would have called her on it, as she calls me on my stuff whenever we see each other not doing our part. So it's mostly testament to the fact that she just is just really good at her job.
And what does that look like when the two of you hold each other accountable?
Usually that means calling each other out after, when we get to the end of the day and they're in bed about to pass out, and say, you know, you really kind of like missed something there. Or you, like, what you did, I'm not totally sure if that's how it should have been responded to. I was expecting you to do it this way and you went this instead. And now I feel weird about what happened. And I think others do as well. Have you thought back about it?
And that could be like a reaction to a client email or in a meeting. Like, that's any aspect of the business.
Yeah. And I think this is just something about the way that we do our work here. I'm like terrified of letting Sarah down. And I'm really terrified of letting my team down. And then everybody else comes second to that. I'm deathly afraid of letting those two groups of people, disappointing them in some way. And my clients and everyone else really is like a distant second. I would feel pretty safe that if I make sure I don't let Sarah down and don't let the team down, everybody else will get served. So I like extra nervous when my team are Like just the other day, I was doing a panel discussion downtown, and one of my team came to see me talk. And I thought I did fine, you know, but I checked in with my team later on and said, hey, so how did I do? Like, do you think I did okay? She goes, oh, no, you did great. So, oh, thank God. I was like worried that I had disappointed her in some way. And once I got her approval, I was like, oh, okay, good. Because everybody else I kind of I'm not as concerned with. But then, you know, like when Sarah and I are like trying to keep each other accountable or keep each other in check, we are, it might show up where it's usually sort of how we are with our team, or like I said, maybe with a client, but because Sarah and I work on two separate sort of, we are never usually in the same client engagement at the same time, because it's just, we can't afford to be on the same things. I don't really see how she is with her clients. I usually just assume she's just fine. But when I see her in something that I can get to witness, it's usually with our team then. And I might mention like, oh man, I really, like I was really expecting you to kind of like respond in this particular way, as in like be a leader. And instead, I think you seem kind of defensive. Can we talk about it? Or she'll do exactly the same thing with me and say, you know, I was really hoping you to be more of a leader here, but you kind of like missed it. What's going on? And I think that our ability to be critical of each other is professionally helpful, of course, but actually is such a foundational part of our relationship, because I know that I don't have to hide anything from her. I know that she could see through everything that I have. There's no pretense. Like I feel like with everyone else, there's a certain level of facade. But with her, I can't afford there to be any, like I am with my family or with others. But with her especially, any sort of facade, I think, will just really make things more difficult.
And do you keep each other accountable for non-work things, like just parenting or partnership?
Yeah. Oh, my God, all the time, because it's all blended together. So what I've been noticing over the last few months, because we things have been more exacerbated with the fact that we just got a newborn, which I don't recommend either. Adding a third kid to an already fully stressed out two-kid family, I have no idea what we were doing. It's not like it was an accident. It was a fully planned, fully consensual, agreed upon planned event. But it's still completely insane what we've done. But it's actually brought up a ton of moments for me where I've been caught off guard with how I am with Elliot, my son. So we have Sophie, who's 8, and Elliot, who's 5, and then we have the newborn called Oliver, who's almost 6 months now. But in the last few months, because just how everything has really kind of exploded with the newborn, it's really brought up a ton of new intentions, particularly between me and Elliot and sometimes between me and Sophie, but exposes all of this stuff that Sarah will be the first to notice and probably the only one to notice. And say like, I'm not really sure why you did it that way. Or like, you know, you're like acting out and being like the child here. Like you're not helping. You're making it worse. So this sounds like we're constantly critiquing each other. But it's just that we need each other to be fully real and fully present, not blowing it. Because there's so many things, not at stake per se, but just like there's a lot going on. And we don't have an awful lot of other help around us. So we need each other to be really doing a lot. So when the other person is not doing that part, you know, minor things will go unsaid. But if it's like something that's fairly big, we'll tell each other, hey, I'm really hoping you to fill in that gap. What the hell happened? Because you've put me in a really compromising position. I needed your help then, and I'm feeling a little screwed. So what's going on? So definitely that is as much parenting as it is running the business. And in both cases, neither of us, I think, had a super clear idea on how to do this well. I think the models that we see out in society are not that great. And I think a lot of it is just kind of us making it up as we go.
And that's parenting or running the business?
Both. I think in both cases, we have examples that are not that healthy and are very dictated. You get sort of like gender norms showing up in the parenting aspect much more so than necessarily in business. I mean, certainly business is not devoid of gender norms by any stretch, but particularly in parenting, Sarah and I have talked a lot about wanting to push back against those norms and those expectations. Because, you know, I'm sure you recognize this as being a dad. Just being a dad and just somehow not being absent gets you, you know, a number one dad award. We have such a privilege to be present and get awarded for it and rewarded for it, as opposed to actually struggling with it and working hard at it and making it like a really big deal. Whereas I think I certainly know this for Sarah, but I think for most women who are parents, they're working 150, 200%, 300% and not getting anywhere near the recognition that I would get or smiles on a street, or like the, oh, you're doing such a good job, that type of like affirmation.
Yeah.
I think it's fully expected that you're just cranking on all those things. And that's now par for the course. That just sounds really unfair.
Yeah. You get like the participation award, like just for, like just for being mm-hmm. there. It's like, my job here is done. Like I didn't abandon my kids, so I win, you know?
Yeah. Like, which, you know, is
totally lopsided.
It is very lopsided. And I think it just makes for a lot of really odd phenomena. It makes for really difficult relationships at home. And I think Sarah and I talked about this through a book called Equally Shared Parenting, which I think really challenges a lot of really good norms for what is expected of you as a dad and as a mom. And some real basic data on the idea that women have taken on huge increases in their responsibility and their sort of representation in the workplace. But the amount of things that are going on for them at home hasn't gone down proportionally. If anything, that went up as well. So for dads to be helping out as much as they can, that's great. But the burden of both the work and sort of the contributions to the household income and all the household duties hasn't gone away for women. So I think she was preemptively telling me, like, I'm not going to put up with that shit. And I don't expect you to cruise through this. So can we talk about it? And we talked about it forever. Before we had Sophie.
Yeah, I was going to ask if some of these same accountability conversations were happening when you were dating or when you were married, but without children, yeah. Or if all this kicked in as like preventative before Sophie was born.
I think if it had been all at once, I think I would have probably made for a really brittle relationship and probably would have snapped it or broken it. We'd started that stuff being very frank with each other and candid from very early on. And I think if we hadn't got through those moments of just like, you know, hey, I really want to give you some feedback. If we hadn't done that early on before all this stuff, I don't think we would have made it. We taught a class together before anything. Like, we were living together and then we got an opportunity to start teaching a class together. And then we started running a small t-shirt business together and then buying a house, then getting married and then having children and then running the business. So we already did a lot of fairly intense things that required an awful lot of feedback and a lot of back and forth. So I think we were getting a lot of good practice on giving each other feedback and also listening well, you know? So when Sarah was introducing the idea of like gender norms, like, okay, I guess this is another thing I should start thinking about, because I certainly hadn't, because being male in North America is you can remain oblivious for a long time. So when she brought this up, I thought, oh, actually, this is not only is it interesting in an intellectual level, I was realizing, and this is, I think, the part that I think a lot of men might miss, is the expectations for us as a dad are just so miserably low. Not only do you get this participation award for just showing up, you're allowed to be crap. You're essentially be given a carte blanche to be like rubbish at this forever. What does that say? Are we that terrible at this? That just seemed really, like, really pathetic. I thought, who am I going to look to for how to do this well? I just thought that was really such a miserable situation, you know?
Yeah. And I'm curious who you did, or if you did look to someone eventually, or find people to start to model yourself after, or if you're still in search of that.
Yeah, it's tough because I was thinking, I was trying to prepare for this chat because I've never had a chat like this. And to have it recorded as well is one thing. But I was thinking about my dad, obviously, and just wondering, like, where is all this stuff coming from? And I don't have a great set of strong, sustained memories of him being all that present growing up. He just worked his ass off the entire time that we were in England because we moved from Burma. So like a lot of immigrants, there was a lot of starting over. At least for my parents, they at least stayed in the same profession, which is they were both in medicine. But, you know, they took a huge step down from where they were professionally to work again and start over. So him being gone a lot was most of what I remember. There are other things that one can clearly remember about sort of having to be told as an immigrant and growing up in England that you're not going to make it very far if you're not working twice as hard. That type of stuff, which I'm sure other families could maybe relate to. But like beyond that, I don't have a strong set of like baseline things. Some of the best stuff I got was from my oldest brother about like how to be a man in quotes, you know, because I would look to him and still look to him for much advice on how to be a grown up and how to be a man. He's really great like that, as is my other brother. But like my dad, I don't have like a lot of lessons that I can recall other than the big ones, you know, like practical day-to-day stuff. Not so much, which would have been really handy actually. So nowadays I'm just wondering, like, I don't know. What does one do for this? because the expectation is so low, I think just being present and then doing things, listening well, all that sort of type of stuff, fairly basic things, actually might constitute as being pretty good these days. And so I'm not sure if I'm answering your question all that well. I'm not sure if I know how to do this excellently, actually.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in these conversations when men have other father figures, alternatives to their birth dad, that they've actually drawn more inspiration from, or maybe their dad has presented them with how not to be. And so they've said like, okay, got it. I'm gonna do everything opposite than this man because it's all not right. And maybe I'll solve it by doing the difference. And so for you, it sounds like you had older brothers who were modeling behaviors, or at least older than you to the degree that you counted on their perspective or advice. Is that fair?
The one thing that I think that's probably the clearest datum, if I was going to measure things against, was like a moral compass. And that comes from my dad and no one else. I continue to be left with stories about him spending time as a student activist in Burma and then having to spend several years in jail protesting against the Burmese government, the military dictatorship that we had back then. And this is all before I was born. So to grow up in England where this like essentially almost like mythical story of my dad having spent time in jail for his beliefs always left me with this impression of like, holy shit, like, are you serious? I am nowhere near in any way putting myself in harm's way. The risk of that happening is so non-existent. I can't even understand who this guy is. And that's actually kind of a tough thing to have in your relationship because I didn't really see him much. And then you hear about this story. It's like, I don't even know how to relate to him. So that's heavy.
Yeah, that's incredibly heroic and sort of out of the league of what most people encounter.
You know, like growing up in England, we were in Surrey. Most of my neighbors, their dads are like mechanics or like work in sales. The comparison isn't even relevant because it's not like I'm going to go, hey, you know, so can we talk about this? No. So then they just left me with this funny impression, like, well, what the hell am I doing with myself? Which to some degree, I think actually has contributed to me wanting to run the studio the way we do. Because I think working as a designer, you know, making plastic products and stuff, didn't exactly compare to like a person whose convictions are so strong that he would put himself in major harm's way. That didn't add up all that well either.
Yeah, I'm curious if either his occupation in medicine or these kinds of ideals or commitments, if they influenced your early creative pursuits. Like how did you make your way from England to the States and the world of design? Like, was any of that influenced by your dad?
I mean, I think for both of them, both my parents, I mean, there was such a strong sense of wanting to be a doctor for a long time when I was growing up in England, going through what was then they called the GCSEs and then the A-levels. So this is all like pre-college. And feeling like if I don't become a doctor, I'm really blowing it. And I felt this odd pressure because my other siblings didn't turn out to be doctors. So it's like, oh man, maybe I'm their last shot, their last hope at making a doctor here. And completely divorced from the reality of me being miserable at mathematics and chemistry and biology, all those things that are fairly necessary to become a doctor, I felt the pressure to become one. So when I ended up finding myself in design, I've been carrying, I think, a long time, still do to a degree, a sense of trying to make up for letting them down by not being a doctor, which is an awful thing to have to carry as a grown-up. They have could care less. This is the irony of it. I've talked to them many times about this. They just don't give a hoot at all now. And I don't know if they ever really did, but I was still left with that heavy weight, whether or not they actively put it on me or I just like put it on myself. I definitely think it has left an impression to want to like make more meaning out of my career, of which I think being a doctor is for Burmese people in general, is like a really good, very handy stand-in for finding meaning in your profession. Like there are so many Burmese people that I know that are doctors. I was growing up thinking like, are there any non-Burmese doctors? I don't think so. I don't know if I know one that isn't. So it's like, wow, maybe they're all doctors. And maybe that's just who my parents were hanging out with. But you know, like it was this impression of, if I'm not doing that, then what the hell am I? And I think I've been asking that myself for a long, long time. So wanting to do the studio is a way of bending my career, like arm wrestling with it until it can fit into some mold to find some meaning. And in that sense, I think it's fairly transparent, actually, if you look hard enough, that's what it's about.
But you found your way into a particular school of thought or discipline within design, I think ahead of a lot of people who are sort of just now waking up to the power of design thinking and, you know, debating the merits of human-centered design. And I feel like you were getting that hands-on at IDEO for years. And then even in the role that you had in between IDEO and Greater Good, you were the, you know, the CTA's first human-centered designer.
Yeah.
First and last? Or is that?
Yeah, no, I got canned after 11 months. That was a short-lived experiment.
But all I'm saying is that's just not design for design's sake, or like the agency life, or the sort of the making of all kinds of things for commerce. There's a thread through that is very much, are we building things that matter to people? Is this useful to people? How do we make this better for people? And that's not always the question being asked when designers are making stuff. And so I feel like I can see a line, you know, from doctors who are making lives better for people. Like, what does that look like in the design world? And I feel like it's a lot of what you've been working towards.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is it's something that I've had to come to terms with, and I think it's also a way of trying to make sense of what all this is for. I do think that there was a certain dissatisfaction that I had when I was at IDEO that led me to eventually quit after 7 years. But the first three or so, I was so unbelievably happy and excited, and I just couldn't believe how lucky I was to be working at this firm with these amazing designers who I thought were some of the best in their field, bar none. It was really quite a privilege to work amongst, I thought, some of the best world-class design team. But I think that niggling feeling of what is all this for, I was noticing when I would talk to my mom and dad, because they continued to be just such a datum, like I described. What I noticed was that the projects I would talk to my parents about, in some cases I would just not mention, and then some I would mention endlessly. Does that make sense? Like it's not like I had an NDA that I had to put, you know, I had to like keep up with my mom and dad. But in those cases when I wasn't all that proud of the project, where there's like frozen pizza or whatever the hell it was, you know, I wouldn't mention it. And I would almost like use the NDA that I had signed as like cover. Whereas in other cases where equally there's some sort of non-disclosure, but it's for like a hospital working on like chronic disease of children, it's like, I'm going to talk about this all day long. And I did. And it's like, that's weird. Why would I be deceptive with my parents over some and not others? Why would I like harp on about some things and not others? What the hell is going on there? And I realized that there's a level of self-deception here that I wasn't willing to admit to, that was connected to the projects and the work that I was doing, that some conveniently would go above the line and that some would not. And I thought, well, the ones that are above the line, there's a quality to them that has a pattern. And all the other ones that are below the line that I never bring up definitely have a pattern and have themes. So I thought, what if I only work on projects that are above the line that I can get to talk to my parents about all day long, since, you know, they're ready to listen, and I have nothing to hide that is like below the line? Wouldn't that A, make it easier for me to have a conversation with my parents every week? So I started thinking, like, what would that look like? And seeing that there wasn't really much of a sector to do social sector design work like we have now, quitting IDEO and going to the CTA was my sort of departure to say, like, this is it. I'm going to try and make this work now. I'm going to try and see if I can have this career change, which I think to me seemed pretty risky, but at the same time seemed like I have to do something because I can't go on like this.
And did they define that role, or did you get there and go, listen, guys, there's this thing, it's called design thinking. I want to do it here at the CTA.
I actually have a lot of regret over how I handled that transition. I went in there also like guns blazing, and I was such a tool. I think I went in there thinking I was such hot shit that I look back on and cringe a lot over how I treated myself and my team and others, because I was really high on having left IDEO and making it as though they were so lucky to have me, that I really, I think, made a lot of errors in this perception of how design was going to play out there. That by the time that the decision to let go of my position, just eliminate me altogether, happened, I don't think it really had built a lot of allies. despite whatever work or impact I may have had, it's a real moment for me to look back on and say, I will never let that happen again, to sort of try to minimize the inherent creativity of an organization, how hard it is to do work in a large organization. I will never underappreciate how challenging that environment is. So I'm really careful to not make those mistakes again when I work with clients who are often buried in organizations like this. But I actually think that when I went in, I thought it was the best job ever. But I think attitudinally, I went around it in a really funny way, which I think I would do over if I could.
It sounds like you took learnings, and I don't know when you arrived at this self-awareness, but applying them to greater good to say, you know, wow, we're going to, if we work in the social sector, we're going to work in a lot of bureaucracy. We're going to work in a lot of government and nonprofit stuff that I think is to some degree why other creative agencies don't. It's like, oh, that works extra hard, you know? And even though it was only 11 months, like seeing it firsthand inside of a public transportation organization like CTA, it sounds like the best thing that could have happened did, in that you've got like empathy and sensitivity to this stuff that you apply to the work every day.
Yeah, it is the best way to describe it now was a long sojourn type research trip. I was like undercover for 11 months. And in that time, I think I had built a lot of empathy and built a lot of appreciation for just how challenging that environment is. And I do hope maybe before, on a bucket list of mine, is to go work on a project for CTA again, actually to make up for some of how I was there. I don't know if I ever get that shot, but I would really like to do that at some point. And actually just start by apologizing to everyone I worked with and then try to get some work done. But you know, but none of that clarity was apparent at the time. It's taken years to get that clarity. But I also think it's the kind of thing that I think if you do work in a commercial business and then look over at the nonprofit sector, I can appreciate how often people kind of dismiss and minimize that sector because I did the same thing. I made the same mistakes. But I think that that's why it deserves more attention than it does and takes more care. And I think that's why it's hard. I don't need everyone to have become work at CTA for a year to appreciate that. But I want them, I would appreciate it if people would not write it off as being a place where the work is any less difficult or less challenging.
Did you start Greater Good with Sarah before or after Sophie was born?
Imagine finding the worst possible time to start a new business is when you have a new baby and say, hey, it's a baby, how much can they eat? Like, it's going to be okay. So starting at the same time, I have no idea why we would decide to do it then. There's never like a good time to take a giant departure on your career and take a huge risk. The safety net that was provided, though, comes from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. So me having a full-time teaching career allowed both Sarah and I to have this leap of faith that without, I don't think we could have done it. I think I will continue to owe them a huge debt of gratitude because without that full-time position and the insurance that comes with being a full-timer, there's no way we could have started this back then. You know, because after CTA, there was like a year spent trying to figure out like, what the hell am I going to do with myself? Because I found myself like without a job suddenly. Worked in commercial design for one more year, and that put the final nail in the coffin of never doing that shit again. And then when I started at the school, we talked a little more about maybe, you know, can we start this thing? And as Sarah was coming back to work with her, with Sophie, I think she was having some real serious question of like, what is all this for? So she had her own sort of wake-up call independently of me, but I think we were both ready to try something new. And that's why we started the studio when we did. So yes, baby time.
Yeah, she concluded her time at another consultancy. You're teaching full-time at SAIC, and both of you endeavor to launch a studio whose sole mission is to serve these organizations and sectors that are hard and are often neglected and sort of go undesigned to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just, we were mostly just curious to see if you can even do a business like this because we hadn't seen or heard of anything like that before where the singular focus was to work with nonprofits and foundations and local government to make it a for-profit business because we had no other idea of how to run a business other than that one and to see if we can even just do it. And that was like the primary question I'd say for like the last 7 years straight is, can you really make this a business? As in like, can it sustain? can you make sure people get paid? Can you have insurance? Can you be like a real company? And now only after like 7 years and we're like entering our eighth now, we're like, whew, okay, I think this works. I think we're ready. I think we can like stop asking that question. I think we've answered the question. The answer is yes, you can. Now the question is like, what the hell do we do with it? Like, what's our role and our responsibility? And perhaps like, what does it mean to be a leader in this field now that we have answered the question of like, can you do it? This is going to sound really like a really the most unstrategic, stupid part of the reason why I wanted to start it was that I know it would bother me so much to watch someone else do this and do it badly. It would just drive me insane. And I knew that the gap was there of like, I'm going to see, like, it's so obvious to me that this is what needs to be filled. And to watch other people fumble their way through it and just do a shitty job of it, I thought, oh my God, that's just going to drive me crazy. Even if we do a terrible job of this, I know at least it's my fault. But to watch some other joker do it and just do it and just like, ah, it's a terrible reason to start a business. But I know it would have driven me nuts to watch people do that and to not have some sort of like say in it or to be involved in it or just like want to fill that giant gap. So, you know, I don't recommend writing a business plan on it, but it is very motivating for me to when I see a leadership gap and to think, well, and then wait for somebody to fill and go, fuck, why is nobody filling this? And then to wait and wait and wait and realizing, who am I waiting for? Who are we waiting for? And go, oh my God, now I got to do this now. I have to do this other thing. It's not like I'm doing it begrudgingly, but more like it just would drive me even more mad to watch somebody do it badly.
No, but it might be the truest, you know, to you as a person.
It's very motivating.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. That feeling when you look around and like, yeah, well, I'm waiting for someone to come lead this. And you look around and everyone's sort of like, I think that's you, you know, like, like if not me, who, you know, and to give it a go, I think is, yeah. I mean, it's driven by something else.
Yeah, like when you look back at it now and, you know, I'll give a talk and I'll try to like find like a really easy to understand, soundbiteable story. There are elements of my career that I can piece together. I can connect all these dots. I can find the through line, as it were. And it sounds great on a TED Talk type of thing. But the really unsophisticated way of describing it is just it would just drive me crazy to watch someone else do this badly. And I think that has been a motivator. Now, as we've gone about running the actual thing and making it work, I owe so much of this business to Sarah's fortitude and her commitment, but also just the fact that she has so little ego that she is not susceptible to that manipulation that I am because of mine. She just isn't motivated by extrinsic things, whereas I completely am. You know, like most of my career is still about trying to satisfy a need that my parents have let go of, and I'm still trying to wait, looking for their approval. So obviously I'm like massively vulnerable to external extrinsic motivation, which is why I think about it a lot, and I'm trying to like work out how to help people be more intrinsically motivated. But she is, and that gives her enormous strength and courage and you know, resilience. And it's enviable. I look and I go, I don't even know how you can do that. I'm like in awe of her because I don't understand how she operates not needing to satisfy someone else's needs. Like, how do you do that? It's amazing.
And just to put some definition, is that fame for what you're doing? Is that recognition of achievement? Is that you asking a colleague after you speak, like, how did that go? Okay, good, good. It was good? Okay, good.
Yeah, I mean, it shows up in wanting to pursue different clients. It comes down to really basic things where we'll get asked to put a proposal together on something. And I know that I've now had to train myself to figure out how much of my ego is motivating me to want to pursue this project, no matter how boneheaded it might be. And because hers is so small and she can see things, I think, a lot clearer than I can, I've had to try to like tamp that down to try to be more clear-minded. That's taken me years. We've actually had to create all sorts of like operational checks and balances. This thing that we call the gut check at our office has done a lot of like cultural impact and like helps for people to feel like there's transparency and decision-making and all these great things. But in many ways, it's actually a tool to shield my team from me. Do you know how nuts that is? We had to create a thing to protect them from me. I'm like a huge liability. Christ.
And does this idea of motivation, intrinsic, extrinsic, does that manifest in parenting or only related to kind of clients and running the business?
So I'm obsessed with this because I think it's one of my biggest challenges as an adult is how do I figure out for myself what is intrinsically motivating me, since I realize, and so I can see so clearly now how futile the pursuit of extrinsic motivations are. And I even had to get to the extent whereby I figured out for myself, this was like a horrible realization one day, was wondering if I'm chasing this dream of being waiting for approval from my parents and that they die one day, what the hell will I do then? You know, they're not like that young these days. If they pass, will I suddenly lose all appetite for this business? That's messed up, man. Can I run a business for 10 years, let's say, and then suddenly like find myself not wanting to do it anymore because my parents have passed, and then realize that like this entire thing was a giant house of cards? You know how stupid that sounds? And then I realized that actually, now that I've thought about it, I think I do enjoy this work just for in and of itself. And then perhaps the extrinsic motivation got me to a place to figure out what the intrinsic was, which is I really do like this work. I like things that are hard. I like working on things that are inherently hard and complicated. And that happens to line up really well with the social sector. It happens to line up really well with running a business in the social sector and, you know, managing this team and trying to find these unicorn type teammates. All of those things are really hard, and I like things that are hard. So I got over that, but it took me a good 6 months of like seeing that and going, oh shit, I'm not ready for this. And then like doing everything I could to not think about it anymore, because I kept thinking if I find out that I don't want to do this in this simulation where they die, what a bozo. I was like really not very happy about that realization. And then once I finally got through it, I thought, it's going to be okay. I have now been very keen to work out what other intrinsic motivations do I have. And I'm wondering now if everybody is also similarly operating under these false external extrinsic narratives. So with my kids now, which is a live experiment as we go, Sarah and I talk a lot about this because she has that foundation because her parents did a great job with her. Her parents are really model parents. They're really very, very lucky to have met Sarah and have seen her grow up as a function of her parents' right-headedness. So we're now practicing with our kids, and I have to practice really hard because I'm so used to using, man, this is rough. Because I was parented by my parents, okay, and I have all of these like extrinsic motivator traits, I'm actually really expert in creating extrinsic motivations in my kids. How would I not be? Does that make sense?
It does.
I'm like a pupil of teachers who have taught extrinsic motivation. I don't know if they knew that, if they necessarily, my mom and dad actually like were intentionally trying to do that, but I'm sure that they were also similarly raised to be the same way. If you imagine my parents being like expert level trainers to get kids to do extrinsically motivated things, I'm really good at that now. I'm like, it's not like I'm dying to make my kids feel guilty and feel terrible about doing things that would disappoint me, but I'm really good at it if I wanted to bring it out. I have to like catch myself and be cautious and really intentional about what I say to my kids about, is this going to leave them feeling like they are trying to prove it to me or to themselves? Half the time I can't even tell because it sounds the same to me because I can't tell which way is up. So it really messes with me. And I'm wondering if in all these ways, like it's all coming up with my son, who's like five, right? He's a beautiful, beautiful boy. I worry I'm like crushing every now and again.
Yeah. That's heavy, man. And is that, go ahead.
No, it's just, I see me in him a lot. And I don't remember much of my own childhood all that well, but I can see it playing out through him. And I'm wondering, like, is this how this sort of like cyclical trauma works? You know, where despite any level of like intellectual awareness, it's so programmed into you that you can't help but repeat it. It's awful.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this the other day about how, you know, stupid analogy. Do you know the Bourne Identity? The movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he wakes up one day and realizes, my God, I'm like this spy and I can kill people with my fingers and all this stuff, right? He's like, wakes up to realize that he's been trained in the CIA for years. I'm like Jason Bourne, but for like a bad parent, where like all this programming has been pummeled into me for years. And it like comes out in the wrong conditions. Like I'll have the right, just the right trigger word or the right like context. And then suddenly I'm explosive with my son. It's like, I didn't even know it was in me.
Mm. Well, thank you for even just saying that out loud, because I think that maybe the premise of this show feels very much like I'm trying to find the experts who have it all figured out, and then you get a glimpse into, one, just how hard it is, but two, that nobody does have it figured out, and that even the people from the outside that I've seen, for them to go like, nah, man, it's not like that at all. It's like this, you know, and it's way worse than you think it is. There's a comfort and relief in hearing that truth from someone who you hold in high regard. So I thank you for that.
I'm just barely holding it together, you know. Like on a good day, everything kind of goes fine. But the bit that terrifies me is that I don't know what will trigger some other response one day. And this is actually just a testament to how awesome my kids are. You know, when I have clarity, I'll be able to tell them later on, hey, Ellie, hey, Sophie, just earlier, I like totally lost it on you guys. I was really upset. Did you notice? Like, yeah, obviously I noticed. Daddy was really losing control. Can we talk about it? They're like, And I said, you know, so sometimes because I'm out of control, I don't know what to do. Can we come up with something to help me notice that? You know, because I can feel myself kind of getting more and more out of control over like the stupidest shit, like nothing, over like a, you know, like a coat on the floor or whatever it might be. And Sophie came up with this thing where we would say, hey, Daddy, I think you're starting to get out of control. She like came up with this like interruption, and she did it one day with me, and it really caught me off guard, because like we came up with a plan, we both agreed, you know, it was like a mini intervention, self-made intervention. And then one morning I was having this morning where I was starting to lose it, and Sophie said, Daddy, can I say something? I was like, what? You know, I'm all upset about like getting breakfast ready or whatever. She goes, I think you're getting out of control. And it's like, ah. And it really caught my breath. I thought, oh shit, you're right. And then my 8-year-old is telling me to calm down because I've given her essentially the permission to do so. And I'm realizing, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, it's really profound. That sort of inversion of roles there, and that you granted that permission and let it play out. I feel like if I did something like that with Javier, which I'm kind of feeling now that I should, like I could see it completely backfiring. Like I could see him being like, Poppy, I think you're losing control. And I'd be like, no, I'm not quite losing control.
Well, I think that's what she was terrified of. She was terrified that she was going to make it worse because I'm already like losing my shit. And it caught me off guard because I thought, damn it, you're totally right. You can see it so clearly. And it really, thankfully, like I didn't get worse. And I caught myself and calmed down, realized I had been interrupted by my child who is being the parent here, because I was basically having a tantrum. And I'm so grateful that my response was to go one way and not the other, because I think if I had gone the other, I would have told her to never do that again.
Yeah.
I would have basically modeled for her that going back on, you know, using this thing that we come up with is a lie, and that interrupting dad, as it were, is only going to lead to more trouble. So when I think about being a dad in general, I've had to think a lot about like, what were the things that were implicitly taught to me by my parents? What was never discussed, but I knew exactly the rule. Do you know what I mean? There are so many things we grow up with that, you know, if a decision was going to go one way or the other, you know exactly where your mom is going to lie on this and where your dad is going to lie on this.
So therefore, I know already which way I'm going to lie on this. And that kind of like implicit ground rules, at least in my family, to me was bright neon lights. It was ultra clear on many things, even though I don't think I could ever tell you where it was written down or like what I could cite as precedence. It was just like, oh yeah, obviously it's this way. So now I'm wondering, how the hell did I figure that out? How was it beaten into me that that was the rule? So then I'm wondering like, holy shit, what are we doing right now? What rules are we setting up with them to be like, obviously this is the way it's going to be? And you get glimpses, by the way. If you see your kids at some point when they like start chatting with each other, I overhear Sophie and Elliot talking about stuff, like about us, you know, us as parents. And you get little glimpses of them debating about, shall I go ask mom about this or ask dad about this? Like, no, I already know the answer. So Sophie already has a ton of these rules that she's basically telling Elliot which way is up.
That's fascinating.
That's crazy to me. She already has like a full handbook on like the employee manual on how to be a kid in our house.
Oh God.
What the hell, dude?
The first time I realized I might be doing damage as a dad, Maris was pulling the car into the garage, cut it a little too close, and like knocked the side view mirror off of the car. And, you know, it made a sound and is kind of hanging, you know, grotesquely down. And I'm sure she let out an expletive or had some reaction to it or whatever. And Javier, you know, from the back seat, said, what just happened? What just happened? And she said, oh, I made a mistake. I backed in and I knocked the mirror off. And he immediately started crying.
Oh, man.
About a side view mirror, you know, which shouldn't mean anything to a child. Mm-hmm. And he said, Poppy's going to be so mad.
Dude.
And it just killed me because he's a kid, you know, he's four. He shouldn't give a shit about a side view mirror, you know, like it means nothing to him. It shouldn't, you know. And in that moment, he just thought, oh, you did it.
You did it,
mom. Like, yeah, this is not good. Like, dad is going to be livid. And it's not like dad's going to hurt us or dad's going to scream and shout.
Sure,
it's just dad's going to be so disappointed. Like, he's going to be so mad, you know. And she texted me from the car as a heads up, you know. And she said, she didn't tell me about Javier, but she just said, like, hey, just so you know, I knocked the mirror off. We're coming upstairs now, you know, and I get this text message with about 5 minutes to get through all my feelings, you know, and I get this and I'm like, God damn it. You know? And I'm thinking to myself, like, how the fuck do you do that? And how many times have you backed into that garage with no problems at all? Like, what was different this time? Like, you know how much that's going to cost? Like, fuck. And I'm all pissed off and they come up the stairs and I'm already like mad about it, you know. And like Javier's, you know, his eyes are wet, he's got like tears in his eyes, and he kind of just like shuffles past me and says something about it, you know, sort of like mommy made a mistake, or you know, mommy did something. And she looks at me and she's just like, she's over it, you know. And she's just like, yeah, this happened, I'm sorry, I don't know, I'm already moving on, you know. She just was like, I don't want to turn this into a thing, and yeah, I wanted to,
you want to make it
stew
a thing
in it a little longer. Yeah, and I really wanted, you know, I wanted her to understand what a fuck up it was and how what an inconvenience it was. Now this is now my problem because I'm the one that's gonna have to go get it fixed and go find a part and like all of this, and like in the end, this was like, you know, this is like $100 repair.
Yeah.
You know, this is nothing.
Yeah,
but then later she said, she told me, you know, what Javier's reaction was, because something else I had done, you know, where I'm flying off the handle and I'm just angry dad, and I'm using this, you know, I'm using a very different voice. There's a growl that I have.
Yeah,
that
I
would never use with any other human.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be so disrespectful and so shitty to like use this aggressive growl with anybody else. But I have like almost no problem doing it with my kid. And so she said, you know, whatever it was, whatever argument occurred later, like, you know, in that moment, she needed to make clear to me what had happened earlier, you know. And she said, this is exactly what I'm talking about. His reaction to you, you know, losing your shit, like that happened in the car and you weren't even there.
Mm.
That's just built in now. Like, he's just got it to where the mere sight of a mistake or something Like, that means Poppy's going to be livid. And that was so hard to hear, because you just have this feeling like, oh, I fucked him up for life, haven't I? You know, it's like, and kids are anti-fragile and they are resilient. And in the end, like, if I'm able to curb this now, like, it won't be a thing, you know, like, I haven't done permanent damage. But in the moment, you just feel like, wow, I've failed this little tiny 4-year-old human in a profound way that, like, I don't even need to be in the room.
Yeah.
And he's like, he's afraid of my reaction.
I think what this reminds me of is the idea that there are our childhoods, and therefore the ones that we're creating with our kids now, are made up of so many thousands of interactions that never make any Instagrammable moment, that are cumulatively powerful in its effect, but not any one instance. And that perhaps he has had thousands of little reminders that will give him that impression, just like my kids have with mine. And I wonder then if we have to therefore, with this awareness, now make commitment to the thousands of interactions it's going to take to undo it and to have them start having a new set of rules. But it takes a lot of intentionality and awareness. So both are really hard. The awareness part is a little easier thing than the intention, but the intention has to be thoughtfully done thousands and thousands and thousands of times. So with all of this programming that is lurking in me, I'm now trying to catch myself when my kids come to me with some either problem or mistake. Because essentially I knew that if I had a mistake or some error or something that would be, this is an Asian family thing, but like bring shame to the family, which is just like the ever-present risk of doing to all Asian families, is brutal, okay? But let's say that something were to happen. I pretty much knew that bringing it to my parents would cause them to be either disappointed or have them lose the handle on me, which essentially was the same thing. Disappointing my parents was just the worst thing you could do. So what I essentially learned to do, this is what I'm terrified of with my kids, is that I stopped bringing them stuff that would even bring me close to them being disappointed. Does that make sense? I would not bring up any errors that I'd made with them. Anything that could possibly bring me within arm's reach of them being disappointed. So what that plays out for me is that the bigger the fuck up that I had done, the less likely I would bring it up with them. And I've done all sorts of fucked up things in my life that legitimately were bringing shame to the family name, that took me forever, ever to finally come clean with them about, because I was so terrified of what they would say and that look on their face with me. So I'm now trying to work out with my actual kids, how do I go, oh, that's a shame. Oh, that's disappointing. Oh, that must have been different than you were expecting. And make it no big deal, because I'm essentially telling them, if I can't handle them spilling a cup of water in bed, which is what happened the other day, and then I lost it on Elliot, which I did, and then felt terrible afterwards, I realized that if he brings me anything more than a cup of water spilling in his bed, which is a perfectly normal thing to do as a 5-year-old, how will I handle him coming home with like, hey, my girlfriend's pregnant, what do I do?
Yeah.
He's never going to come to me with that. Thousands and thousands of little lessons that I'm essentially telling them which way is up. I have to work on it now. The tiny infractions. Because the big stuff is going to come. And that big stuff, what they're going to do is they're going to tell their friends. Hopefully they'll go to my wife instead. Or they'll go to like some other random person instead of me. Or no one at all, and they'll go on their own with it. And then it's like, best of luck to you. Dude, this is heavy shit. This is heavy, heavy, heavy podcast. You wanted to ruin me for the afternoon. Great. Thanks. You're welcome.
Man, just think about think about how many dads are hearing this and thinking, fuck, I got a bunch of micro interactions to work on. You know what I'm saying? Like, That's what I'm most excited about, is because there's no conversations happening at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. But some of the things that we're talking about are universal, have nothing to do with being a designer or a maker or an entrepreneur or a business owner, you know, studio principal or anything. Mm-hmm. They're just hard things about being a parent. And so I'm hoping that one, that, like, you know, the name Dadwell isn't limiting to the audience and who listens, because I think that there are There are amazing insights and revelations about just being a parent that's just coming up, you know, in these conversations. And I'm grateful for people's willingness to go there. And it's a deep honor to make a space to talk and to give room for men to be open about fatherhood, because we're friends and we've known each other for years. Mm-hmm. And we've talked around being dads and, you know, our kids' lives, but we haven't sat down ever.
You know how sad it is that you have to create a brand and then involve technology for us to have what will constitute the longest conversation you and I have ever had. I don't know what that says about our relationship. That's sad. But also, but the fact that we are doing it, I'm glad and I'm grateful for, because when else am I going to bring this up?
That's right.
The other dads I know all struggle with this too. None of the dads I know have any of their shit together any more than any of us do. I don't know what that says about the previous generation of dads either. Again, I think the expectations are just so miserably low that not being a total absentee counts. So what does excellence look like beyond just showing up is a giant mystery.
Well, when it's that low, it can only go up.
Yeah, but I think we have so little practice with it on a regular basis that just from going from like mediocre to good, but then good to great, I don't think we're not even there. So like, is there a big bank of what good looks like? Sure. I mean, obviously being a good dad, I would imagine, as it is true with me, requires a partner that is equally conscious and present of what it means to be a good mother. If anything, I think it's harder for her, as I'm sure it is for Maris, to be good at this stuff as well. But she has the same moments of paralysis as I do. I mean, we try to keep each other not only in check, but also a rock when the other person is totally losing it. Sometimes it's actually easier when the other person is losing it, because then I think Sarah and I know how to respond and be that rock while the other person is kind of like flailing. But I think if we go back to the idea that these spaces that we're talking about are so rare, I wonder if the lens of what it means to be a person of color and a dad, and that to raise, in my case, and I guess in yours too, mixed race kids in America is tricky, because growing up as I did in England, I think I mentioned this earlier, that heavy weight of being an immigrant really colored my experience as a child, as a kid. I haven't decided yet whether to do that to my son and to my daughter, whether to like have the talk about whether or not they need to recognize where they are in this society. And a part of me wonders if like, do I have to, because they kind of pass as white, but I don't know. I don't know, man. I don't know if I'm doing them a disservice by not bringing it up. I'm sure my dad did it as a way to protect me. It has all these other implications, which I can talk about. But like, I think in his mind, if he didn't, he would have felt like negligent.
I feel that same tension. And I think I'm thinking about it from the other angle, like as a Latino and as a Puerto Rican who married, a white Jewish woman and whose kids are very white looking, you know, Javier has blue eyes, blonde hair. Fair skin.
Yeah, the kid's gorgeous. You know. I mean, he's all set. Really, he's all set.
And, you know, I was so grateful that Amaya was born with brown eyes and brown hair. Oh. For no reason other than like, you know, I would like one of them to, you know, to look like me or to look Latina. I guess my point is there is a lot of Jewish identity in our home and in our friend circle, and you know, the fact that we attend a Jewish community and are, you know, contributing members to a congregation of people, I feel like I have to fight hard, and not because Maris is like standing in its way or preventing it, but like I have to fight hard. I have to be active at bringing Latin identity into our house, and the fact that she speaks a little bit more Hebrew than I speak Spanish, like I'm already feeling like the ratio of Puerto Rican identity and Jewish identity is like way off.
It's a cultural arms race. That's right. Yeah.
And so like Javier loves folk music. A lot of the music that's sung at our synagogue, like he's into that music. And so like that's often playing like in our house and things like that. And like, I have to commandeer Alexa and be like, Alexa, play salsa as loud as you can, you know, like, yeah. And it's not like Maris is standing in the way. Like, you know, she's very open to like all kinds of music. It has nothing to do with her. It has everything to do with me feeling this funny feeling. And we're talking about racism. We're talking about things like that now as Javier gets older and sees more things and has more questions. And, you know, he was talking about my grandmother, his great grandmother, who has brown skin and physical features that are in ways unlike people in our house and that he sees every day, right? Like, you know, he'll just ask about that, about these physical attributes and about these things. And I'm like, that's as much you as anything else. Like, I feel like this compulsion to remind him, like, you're Puerto Rican, dude. Like, you are Puerto Rican. Like, everybody on Poppy's side of the family is Puerto Rican, you know, as far as we can trace things. And that is not other to you. I need you to own that as much as you own your Jewish identity. And it gets hard to explain that to a four-year-old, and he doesn't care, you know, but like, even down to something as small as, I hate when he calls me dad or daddy.
Oh, really?
Because all his friends call their dad's daddy.
Yeah.
I want him to call me Poppy. It's been Poppy from the jump, you know, like.
Man, I've never, that's brilliant.
It drives me nuts though, because brilliant. He comes home from hanging out with them and he's like, daddy. And Maris knows that it makes me nuts, you know, and I literally say every time he says, dad, daddy, I say, that's not my name.
Mm.
And then he says, Poppy, and he corrects himself. Mm-hmm. And like, it got to the point where I was like, Javier, this is such a simple thing. All I'm asking is for you to call me Poppy. It's so basic. And I said, a good way to think about it is if you're ever lost and you call out daddy, a million dads are going to turn and think, oh, is that my son? But if you call out Poppy and we're not in Humboldt Park, there's a really good chance that I'll be the only person that hears you, you know? And then I said to him, you know, and if you can't understand this, then I'm going to have to start to call you other names.
Oh, bang.
And it made him nuts, you know, because
that's rough.
You know, he'd say like, daddy, can I have this? And I'd be like, I'm sorry, Frank, I didn't hear you. What'd you say?
Oh, bloody hell.
And I'm like, Billy, Jimmy, Kevin. And he's like, that's not my name. And I'm like, exactly.
Oh,
call
man.
Me Poppy. Like, why is this so fucking hard for you? Yeah, man. So these like little culture wars, and they're all in my head. You know, again, like nobody in the family is standing against these things. But I feel like he has to understand, besides the fact that your name is Javier Garcia, there's very little indicator that you are anything other than just like a blonde-haired, blue-eyed little white kid. And I don't want him to be self-conscious or embarrassed or anything about that, because he's beautiful the way that he is. But I want him to understand that besides your physical characteristics, you are as Puerto Rican as any other Puerto Rican. And it's just really hard for me.
Yeah. It's bringing up lots and lots of questions of what am I bringing to this cultural equation? And then I'm realizing, because of my upbringing in England, I think this is connected to them, but I think that my parents' strong push, my family's strong push to wanting to be more Burmese and more Asian when they're essentially an immigrant family growing up in the UK. I can imagine this happens to other people if they go to another place. They want to retain as much as they can of their culture when they transplant. But I think for me, it had the opposite effect and wanted me to kind of drive me a little crazy to be as English as possible. As a coping strategy, not that I was actively trying to not be a Burmese, but if anything, I just wanted to fit in and not stick out. The rest of my siblings, I think, have different relationships with that and different levels of wanting to become, of wanting to assimilate. I think some of my siblings actively were like, no, fuck this. I'm going to be even more Burmese now as a way to distinguish themselves. But I think for me, it was really wanting to hide. And what's really tough about that now is that suddenly at the moment when I'm trying to raise our kids now, I don't know if I have like a deep well of Asian culture to draw on, because I think I lost a lot on myself in wanting to be as white as possible growing up in England like I did, which is, so it makes me go to what? What the hell am I then?
My cousins have two sons and they adopted their daughter from India. And we were just having a conversation recently, and I had asked if they had plans to go back to India at any point with their daughter. I was more curious than I was anything, like, how are you thinking about this? Or like, are you doing anything? Like, maybe you don't have to do anything, or maybe there's lots of work to do. But I was sort of wondering, like, how much of her Indianness do you plan to acknowledge, embrace, like bring forward to her? Like it's up to them, you know, until she gets to a point where she's like, oh, I'm going to go discover my roots, or I'm going to, you know, whatever, explore this thing. He was very conscious of it and I think is actively working with his wife and to kind of think about, like, we know other families who have adopted children from India. And so we also like spend time with them so everyone can sort of be together and be learning together. And we know that we need to actively do this. Like that might be bringing her to some Indian cultural event or an Indian holiday celebration, or just spending time on, you know, on Devon Avenue, the cultural enclave of, you know, Indian community in Chicago. All of those seemed good. Like those all seem like, yes, do all of those. Those all sound awesome. And some version of it will be the right thing. You know, some combination of these sort of exposure experiments will work. And I thought that was really interesting as like, well, he's Puerto Rican and Polish. His wife is white. And now they have a little Indian daughter and they're doing the best that they can as non-Indian parents, right? Like, it's why it matters so much to me that Javier comes with me to Fiesta Boricua in Humboldt Park every summer. Like, he needs to see this outpouring of Puerto Rican identity, even if it is once or twice a year at this cultural event. It's really important that he goes and he sees that and that he doesn't feel like a visitor, but like, you know, I'm putting him in his little Puerto Rican flag jersey and we're dancing to salsa and we're getting food from the vendors and we're just spending time where he can see all the different flavors of Puerto Rican identity. And, you know, I'm not good at it. I'm not fluent in Spanish. There's a lot of things that I could be better at. And so I kind of leverage the community and I sort of bring him to where that is concentrated in Chicago and, you know, Logan Square and Humboldt Park. And maybe through osmosis or just wishful thinking, I hope that he absorbs some piece of it and comes away feeling like that's him too, you know? I struggle with it. When I found out that Bruno Mars was Puerto Rican Jewish.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you don't know how like over the moon I was.
I had no idea. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's wild.
I was like, this guy right here, like, you know, he's
that's pretty rad.
He's Latino, he's Jewish. Like, you don't have to be like Bruno Mars, but like, goddamn it, I'm glad there's an example of somebody out there that, you know, you can point to and sort of identify with. It's so funny.
Yeah, I'm thinking as you've been talking and just you know, this podcast as a whole, connecting back to some of the stuff we talked about, why am I doing this work? I've been trying to, I think, piece my way back to an identity that has some contribution back to being Asian, as fragmented as it is. And I've been noticing how in the work that we do when we work with our clients, how many moments that kind of relate to Buddhism, how there is a real strong emphasis in the work that we do is about honoring reality as it is, which at its core of Buddhism is meditation. And the core meditation is just seeing things really as they are. I wonder if there's a part of me trying to figure out how to be Asian despite everything else at an intrinsic level. Because I think there is an affect one can have. There is the garb one can wear, and there is the trinkets you can surround yourself with. But I think if the question is, well, what does it really truly mean to be Asian? I don't know. I don't know what that is. But I think perhaps part of me trying to figure that out is trying to work out in my work, is there a truth here that actually relates to something I already know, which thank God I grew up with, which in my household went basically my dad being a meditator, a hardcore meditator, and then making my mom a hardcore meditator, and then slowly forcing everyone, including me, and I like dragged my feet on this forever, to become meditators. That might be the best way of me expressing my Asianness, is to meditate and to think about my work in Buddhist terms, which, you know, doesn't make any sense. If I was to ever write that down on a website, I'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? That sounds crazy. I'm not hiring you to be a Buddhist. I hired you to like design a website, goddammit, you know, like, but there is a connection in my mind, at least, to that truthfulness, that pursuit of wanting to see reality as it is, not as we wish it were to be.
I like the you know, the sort of breakdown of like, here's three ways that you can reflect culture, you know. And I think a lot of times I default to the trinkets, you know, like my grandmother sent from Puerto Rico a guido, which is like a hollowed out gourd, and you can play it like an instrument with like a little wire whisk. You run it along the ridges of this carved gourd. And it was so special when it came in the mail because, you know, Javier's really into music. And I thought, like, this is perfect. Like, here's a musical thing. You love music. And this musical thing is uniquely Puerto Rican or Caribbean. And he liked it and he played with it. And, you know, he's into electric guitar, so it's not like his favorite thing. But it was that little thing where I was like, yes, I need more of these little bits around. And then I think like, oh, how superficial and weird. Like, being Puerto Rican is not playing the guido. Like, that's not it. You know, it's all these other things. And for a long time, I beat myself up about not speaking Spanish. And I think it's probably, you know, when we talk about parental regret, it's probably my parents' biggest regret is that they didn't teach me Spanish. And you know, they grew up in the city in Chicago. And when they had me, they moved to the burbs and they assimilated and, you know, consciously and subconsciously. And Spanish was like the language they used when they wanted to talk about Christmas presents without me knowing about it, you know? So it was like the secret language, you know? And my sister, smartly, 12 years my junior, she made it a point to study Spanish in school, to live in Spain. She's fluent. She intends to use it in medicine. And it's like, okay, cool. Like she figured it out. But for me, I felt like, man, like Javier's really got to learn Spanish. Like this might skip a generation, but like he's got to, like, I don't know how to stress this to him without getting it to the point where he resists or revolts. Like, no, Dad, you're pushing too hard on the Spanish thing. I want to learn Japanese, you know?
Can we talk about that for a sec? Because I feel like there's this moment right now that it's playing out in front of me pretty much every day, and I'm easy to miss it. My kids love eating rice. Whenever we've made a pot, they'll devour it and just like rip through it. I was forced to eat rice all the time, and I constantly pushed against it. I love rice. Like I objectively love this stuff, partly because it makes me feel Asian, partly makes me feel like a reminder of home, and it's genuine, like just quantifiably, objectively awesome. And I think my kids know that, but I've never pushed it on them, and I'm realizing how I've just left it be a thing that's available. And in contrast to how I remember it being offered, I'm wondering if I should be much less directed about things that are available to try and see if I can have that same intuitive love for a thing, which may or may not be Asian, that I would wish they could just find on their own. Because now they love rice way more than any kid I know. And I feel like my parents will be thrilled with how much rice they're eating, almost to make up for the fact that I barely ate it at all. I was like, see, I'm not a total screw up.
The happiest moment in my life was when a friend who is an amazing chef and culinary expert had invited us over and had said something to Javier of like, well, you know, when you come over, I'll make you whatever your favorite dish is. And she said, you know, what's your favorite food? What do you like best? Proudest moment in terms of food. He says, Puerto Rican beans and rice.
Whoa.
It was joy that, like, out of all the things that he's eaten, beans and rice were his favorite thing. And then it was also this, like, booyah moment where I was like, and there's no fucking way you can make Puerto Rican beans and rice better than me. So good luck, lady. Like, it was just, it felt so good because I was like, oh, no one's going to beat grandma's recipe. And that's how I make it. And so this is amazing. Like, yeah, I still have your heart until you taste, you know, like truffle fries or something else, you know, amazingly delicious. Man, it was awesome.
That was a crowning moment for you.
Yeah. I'm curious in this idea that we've been talking about intentionality and the sort of things that we expose our kids to, you know, whether it's out of trying to steer them in a particular way or just, you know, hey, this matters to me and I think it's interesting and I'd love for you to like it too. Like, are you intentional about your children's creativity and creative opportunities since that's the space that you live in?
Both obviously Sarah and I run a creative practice. Even though we both studied engineering, we both feel like we're designers and we're in this design industry and have lots of designery things and all those like trinkets that we just talked about. Yes, it's all around us.
I think what would be my greatest fear is that they end up as lawyers working for BP or something and just like actuaries. I don't know why I have this awful bias against actuaries, but I feel like that would somehow like kill me. Whereas obviously if they're like ecstatically happy about doing actuary science and like wanted to do that, I should be happy for them. Yet I somehow have this awful resentment towards that. In my mind, a very different field. I don't know why. I don't know how I'm going to respond if they want to do all these other things that I have no. But I'm wondering if their intuitive aptitude for creative pursuits. I am trying to be very careful about not wanting to overly stoke it so that they actually either do it for me, overly stoke it so that they end up doing it and push back against it, or underserve it and have them somehow like waste away something that was of interest. I mean, what I'm noticing with both the kids right now is that they're really good at everything. I mean, I think most kids are probably good at all things that they try, and that they have equal interest in drawing, writing, model making, running around doing sports, being silly. I mean, all of it. I mean, one very intentional thing that Sarah and I are adamant about, which I think is probably a little counter, is limiting their exposure to screens and devices. So there's a part of me that says, well, you know, what would it be like if Sophie had an iPad and she could like make little movies? And I, you know, see examples of that a lot. And I wonder if I'm like limiting her ability to be more creative because of the lack of access to tools. And then I usually go, no, it's okay. She will be fine. She will be probably more creative from the limitation of those things than necessarily the pure unbridled access to it all. She like made a book the other day. She wrote like a multi-chapter. I mean, her handwriting's really good. It's all learning in cursive. And she like studiously writes chapters of pages of stuff with like stories about characters who have dialogue. I can't believe she's writing dialogue. It's blowing my mind. So I'm like, I would ask her, how are you doing this? She goes, I read books, Daddy. I'm like, oh yeah, that's how you do it. Like, that's how you figured out how to do dialogue and have characters. And like, they go to things and they do stuff. And yeah, it's blowing my mind. So I'm trying to do as little as possible in terms of interventions around this area. I'm trying to leave it be as much as possible to let her figure out for herself what she wants and what she's good at. And I think that there's this really direct tension to wanting your kids to be successful and your urgency around it, which I think has gotten much worse in the last 30 or 40 years when we were kids. That urgency to make your kids be successful is counterintuitively more likely to limit their ability to be successful. So I'm trying to figure out with Sarah, I think, like, how little can we do without being negligent? Because I think the more we do, I think the more it's going to get in the way.
Yeah, I love the idea of bringing a designer's mindset or just an openness to whatever it is. And I think the people who are most successful in the industry probably brought some level of experimentation and collaboration and curiosity to their work. And that's how they unlocked something or achieved the new thing or bucked the orthodoxy or traditions of that industry and did something wholly new. And those are the people we talk about in medicine or engineering or maybe even in law, you know, people who are looking at, you know, redefining intellectual property and tech IP and other ideas, they're experimenting. They're defining new dimensions for law. And that's maybe that's the idea, is bringing that mindset to whatever the work is, even if it is, you know, something that feels very calculated. I'm curious, along the lines earlier, you said in evaluating your kind of interest in this work and what if that melted away if the expectations there changed, and you had said, but I came to the conclusion that I like hard things. I like the challenge of this work. I'm curious, somewhere underneath that decision to have a third kid and like add to the hardness,
to make things harder. Jesus Christ.
Because, man, you know, you're running a practice. You've got a fairly lean studio. You're doing really powerful and important work. And then you add to the mix like a whole other human.
Yeah. We were thinking of actually adopting next.
Oh, God.
and then also running an orphanage. I don't know if we were just thinking, man, we just cannot wait to blow up what we have right now. But I think that there's a part of both Sarah and I coming as she's the oldest, but I'm the youngest of family of four kids each. Perhaps wondering if perhaps we needed to have more, or that it would feel more normal if we had more. I don't think we're anywhere near having four. I think that is just batshit crazy. Three, I think, is the new four these days. But I think three is so, I still don't understand why we've done it. It's on hard mode. That's probably the best way to put it. It's parenting on hard mode. We do have a lot of good systems in place. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is probably, if you're trying to get to like a practical tip, as you're having a relationship pre-dad, ideally, is to figure out what systems you have in place for feedback, and also whether or not you're going to like practice regularly putting yourself in harm's way and actually have some stressful things go through your life. That's always good prototyping for being a parent. But as you get one and then two kids and possibly more, figuring out the systems for the really mundane things like who's going to cook and when the cooking is going to happen, or like how a meal's going to be provided. And then second things like laundry and then trash and like those basic stupid things that are so mundane that you would think require so little creative thought. Actually, it happens so frequently. I do think some creativity would go a long way to make that a smooth system. Because when those systems aren't there and you add children or add stress, add taxes, add family, add like aging parents to the mix, that lack of a foundation can make everything super stressful. Whereas if you have the foundation of like, I know how to get meals made, I know how to get kids changed, I know how to get diapers done, I know how to get laundry done, all that stuff, I think provides you some stability and frankly, even like some respite. Because at least that bits you can control when everything else is so wildly out of your control. Maybe that's why we felt like we could add a third, but it is a ballsy move on our part for sure. Because the last 6 months we've definitely moments when I'm I'm looking at Sarah going, I don't know if you realize how on fire everything is. I think I'm on fire. Have you noticed I'm on fire? And if you haven't noticed, I'm letting you know right now. And then we'll like have this discussion while everything's going nuts. And I think we've got to a point now where, because he's sleeping, you know, we did sleep training, we have daycare. I think we got to a fairly good place now. You know, I think it's probably going to make it. And this is just a personal like cry for help that we put out was actually we're going to move my in-laws in next door. We got the apartment next door. So my in-laws are going to move in one corridor away from us. So I can't wait for that to happen. That will be another like big stabilizing factor. But I think if you have the capacity and have the means to set up some of these systems, I think it will make parenting a little more manageable.
I have one last question for you. Does being a designer make you a better or worse dad?
I think it makes me a very observant dad. It's probably maybe the best way to describe it. And it's made me question a lot about what I was shown, and then deeply question whether or not I know what I'm doing. And that perhaps as a designer, I could probably create some of this with my kids, actually, as well as with my wife. I think it's unfair to imagine that you can just do it all on your own, or that you're somehow meant to know how to do this well. So the conclusion is, well, then what does it mean to be a good dad? And I think thankfully as a designer, I have some practice at coming up with new ideas. And perhaps if you put the frame around that constraint of saying, well, what does it mean to be a dad? Well, between 6 and 8 p.m. when you pick up the kids and get up to bed, or during the breakfast time, how to be a good dad, or on the weekends and other bits and pieces. That's like a design problem. I've never thought of it that way until just now, but you could argue that that's a set of constraints that designers are used to having. Yeah. Maybe that's how I'd answer it. That's a really tricky one. I hadn't thought of it that way before.
I'm glad I saved it for the last few minutes when you need to leave.
Antonio, thank you so much for this.
Yeah.
Good luck with this.
I appreciate it, man. My pleasure. And thanks again for your time. I love talking with you.
Yeah. I cannot wait to hear when all this goes live. I'd love to see how this comes together with other people's stories. It's very interesting.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that.
Did you ever think about, by the way, other, this is totally not to do with being a dad, but rather about trying to get everything done. And I think that there is a component to being Buddhist that helps me with this, which is that I believe in multiple lifetimes. Okay. So the whole notion of YOLO and that you only live once is like the completely the opposite of being a Buddhist. Okay. The idea that you have thousands of lifetimes, and that sadly in Buddhism, it's mostly because you haven't attained a level of peace, but still. Part I'm taking away from this is that you don't have to worry so much, I think, about trying to get everything done in this lifetime. And that perhaps there are other lifetimes where I can be a photographer because I still desperately want to be one. And that there's also a lifetime perhaps where I make music all day long. But in this lifetime, I don't think it's going to happen for me. Which is a it's sad to say, but I've had to come to peace with it because it means that I'm not distracted by that pursuit because I already have a life that has a lifetime's worth of work to do in. Does that make sense? So I'm wondering if perhaps I can come back another time where running Greater Good is not my lifelong work, but maybe music will be. And there's another lifetime where I'll be a chef, and there'll be another lifetime where I can be a photographer. And those would be the first top four, because I feel very lucky to have the one that I have, which is so lucky because I get to do this design work all day in all of these ways. I'm trying to let go gracefully the other things and not feel bad. So like I'm like co-opting Buddhist reincarnation as a scapegoat to let go without feeling so bad. If one were to let things go, there's a mourning to it. There's a loss that you have to manage. I haven't heard anybody talk about that. You know, being a grown-up means managing your loss of all these things. And essentially being content with the one that you have, the wife you have, the kids you have, the life you have, the career you have, all those things. And there actually is peace to be found in the one you have, more so than you've given it credit for, because you've been told by fucking Instagram and all these other bullshit that something else is always better. No, it's not. It's totally not. The one you have is great, if you just noticed. But that comes at a loss of those other dreams, which sounds awful when you say it out loud. But there's actually a lot of peace to be found, which I'm starting to realize is more valuable to me than the excitement and the thrill of some of those things that I was pursuing. Because I know that in the pursuit of trying to make a career out of cooking, which I would love to do, I will hate it. I actually think it's going to get beaten out of me. Whereas thankfully, thank God, I still enjoy doing this business. Because you could imagine, like, I could dream about being a designer and then hitting the reality of doing it every day would suck if it wasn't still enjoyable. I would have quit by now. But I'm pretty sure if I was trying to do full-time photography, music, or cooking, those happen to be my pet dreams, I think I would hate it. So that's part of the narrative I'm telling myself to let it go. To see how transparent it is. But like, I'm trying to let it go gracefully because I think if I keep holding onto it, it's just going to make me miserable.
Amen, brother.
All right, so that was an extra bonus appendix.
I know. I'm going to end the show. I'm going to be like, but wait, there's more.
I just wanted to talk about it because I think I just realized before we ended, like, oh man, I want to talk about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, dude. I'm glad that I caught it all in this recording. I like it a lot.
Antonio, thank you so much for letting me talk for a long, long time. It's rare for me to get this much of someone's attention. So thank you, Antonio. That really helped a lot.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a quick review on iTunes. As a first season podcast, this helps a ton, and it would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of them. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter and even cop some fresh Dadwell merch. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks again for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.